shifting to another topic again. Have you heard about the Hessdalen project in Norway?
Yes.
Where light phenomena has been observed several times.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain that, or do you have any comments on that, what that could be?
No, you know, I read the reports, and all UFO reports are amazing to me because they all have differences in detail. Every report has something new in it. So I keep looking for another report because I know I'm going to find something new. I'm interested in that. There was a case in Norway where a woodcutter came on a landed craft or a damaged craft. It might have been, not have been damaged, and the occupant was out of the craft. And he attacked it and killed it, died before his eyes there. And he left and went home. When he came back the next day, there was no sign of it, and no sign of the landing of the craft. And I copied that. I have that story in my file there because it was a unique story. There's so many unique stories in this whole phenomena. It's hard to tell where the fact stops and fiction starts. And you have to be real careful. You have to do a lot of checking to get away from being misled.
I mean, that's probably the main question from people who are skeptic. You know, how can you know that these stories are true, and how can you verify them? Are there any evidence, and so on?
You know, I have the same problem. But when I am investigating a case and watch the life change of the contactee over time, I have to be convinced that he's not doing it to himself. In the Bill Herman case, for example, he didn't believe in UFO. He's a born-again Christian in the Southern Baptist Conference Church. And they believe that all UFOs are manifestations of the Antichrist and representations of the devil. Don't get involved with those forces. They're negative. So he found his little friends to be very benign, very benevolent. They were very careful not to disturb his wife, who was afraid of the UFO phenomena. He knew that they weren't devils in the first contact. When he woke up on the examining table and saw the little creatures there that looked like overgrown fetuses, and the whole room had an ambient reddish light in it, so they looked redder too. But in white light, they still had a pinkish cast to them. Anyway, he was driving his car with his wife one time when it started making low passes over the car. He stopped the car and got out with his wife. It came so low over the car, he said, I couldn't have thrown my camera and hit it. And his wife still refused to accept him as anything but devils. And a time came when his church began excommunication proceedings for him and his wife. He was a deacon in the church. He passed a collection plate. He taught the Sunday school to help teach the church records. And still that church started excommunication proceedings to kick him out of the church because he was in league with the devil. So he didn't want to lose his family. His wife believes the church. She thinks they're devils. And she finally told him that after they started excommunication proceedings, she said, if you don't give up the devils, you're going to have to, we're going to leave. I'm going to take our daughter and leave, and you'll never see us again. We don't want any part of this. So they went to the church to pray with his minister. And they prayed for hours. And finally the minister said, I am sure that we can get rid of this problem. We're going to go to your house. We're going to take all the pictures, all the negatives, all the notes that you've made, all the sketches you've made, all the diagrams, all the automatic writing you've taken, which is the work of the devil too, and all of that, and even a little metal object that the aliens had given him as a memento of some kind of recognition, former recognition of something. And they packed them all up, took them down to the big deep water pier in Charleston, threw them off in a heavy surf, and the package was broken up and the contents were scattered. The little aliens came back to him the next day and said, we understand that our little memento had little intrinsic value, or little actual value to it. It was a lead bar with symbols on it. Had little actual value, but it had great value to us. We have recognized only one other Earth human with such a emblem. And then he felt bad about it, because he knew they weren't devils, but he didn't want to lose his family, and he's going to live the life. But that was an interesting case because this guy, if anybody had tried to tell him anything about UFOs before his own involuntary first abduction, he would have laughed at him. Mm. He would have ridiculed him, laughed at him, and thought they were crazy. Now it happened to him, and he knows it's not crazy. And they're not devils, and they're not what it was all alleged to be. And he had a good relationship with them. They began calling him their Anbati, whatever that means. That's coming out of the lexicon, too. And that's after they said, "You will be our Anbati on Earth," they delivered the medal. Now, here's how it happened. I was trying to get him to remember symbols he saw on the control panel, because he saw a number of symbols different from our writing. And he was sitting in his bedroom. His mother was, his wife was babysitting with her mother, who was an invalid and needed round-the-clock nursing, and they couldn't afford to nurse from midnight to 6 o'clock in the morning, so his wife always went to do that. So after his wife had gone, he was sitting at the table in his bedroom trying to remember some of the symbols he saw on the control panel. And as he was trying to get some symbols created here, the room began to get lighter, like somebody turning up a rheostat. And he knows he had no rheostat on the switch, just an on and off switch. And the light kept getting brighter and brighter, and he turned around to see. And there in the middle of his bedroom was a ball of light, pulsing and crackling, and sparks shooting out and back into it like this, and growing and getting bigger. At a point when it was about one-fourth the size of the room, he panicked and screamed. And then it stopped growing and started getting smaller again. And as it got smaller, it moved from over his bed down over the corner of the dresser like this, dimmed down to about the size of an orange and went out. And when it went out, this little metal bar was laying on the corner of his dresser. This little metal bar was hot. He picked it up, went right to the telephone and called me and told me about it while he's still holding the hot bar in his hand. When he finally set the bar to me and I looked at it, the symbols didn't make any sense to him at all. But when I looked at it, it was the major stars in the constellation Reticulum as seen at zenith from the point directly below Reticulum on the surface of the planet. That's in the South Polar area. There's no telescopes down there. There's no picture image that shows those stars in that configuration. It had to have been taken from someplace else to have those symbols in that particular configuration on that little bar. And the symbols represented the main stars in the Reticulum system and a point showing where their particular planet was on Zeta 1, third planet out. But that was thrown into the surf with everything else. So the little Reticulan aliens came back one more time. They said, "We understand your problem, and we're not going to interfere in your life anymore. And we know that this bar had little value, but it meant a great deal to us, and that they had rescued it. And they said that we will not bother your life anymore. And if they came back, he had told nobody about it because his church would start up again." Mm-hmm. So I am almost convinced within my own mind that he may occasionally have a contact with them because his progress with them after about 6 or 7 trips with them aboard their craft elsewhere and brought him back safely, that I don't think his contact's fully ended there. I think that they have some kind of relationship with him still that he doesn't dare to tell his wife or his pastor about, and he's a very devout Christian. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you have learned in connection with what the crafts look like, for instance, inside? How big are they and how many?
That's an interesting thing because we have observers that have been taken aboard the craft that see the craft one size on the outside, and when they get inside, it's much bigger or appears to be much bigger. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to treat that. I don't know whether they are diminished in size when they go inside and it appears to be bigger in that respect, or whether it actually appears to be bigger, or whether it grows after they go through the door. Don't know, but it's a phenomenon that is often reported.
Mm-hmm. But what do they see? What do they experience inside?
Often report light from the walls. No point light source in the room, but the well-lighted. The seating is comfortable, soft seating, but it's neither metal nor plastic nor leather nor anything like that. It's always something different. Tables are often cool, hard, they're firm but not hard, the examining tables. Instruments usually are, they touch a panel on the wall and it opens and take an instrument out that they're going to use, and maybe on a line or maybe on an arm or something like that, and it's put back in the wall and the panel closes again. The rooms are pretty clean otherwise. There's always a number of viewing screens in, set into the walls and around an examining table where they watch everything. There was a case south of Guayaquil in Ecuador where a man was fishing, and he saw an orange light approaching over the trees across the river, and it came right down towards him. The orange light dimmed down to a reddish metallic looking craft, dull metallic looking craft, continued to descend right down over the river in front of him, extended legs and landed with two legs in the water and one on the sand beside where he was fishing. A ramp came down and a little creature came down from the craft. He was about four foot 2 or 3 inches tall, looked like a male creature, had a disproportionately large head. He walked up to him and addressed him by name and said, Jose, would your wife be willing to carry one of our fetuses for a time? Our race has a problem in evolution. We have lost our emotional sensitivities, and we think that if we know that your race has strong emotions, we're thinking that if your race could carry one of our race for the initial stages of incubation, it might receive some of this emotional potential again. We might be able to recover some of that. So he said, well, I'll ask her. But he said, I don't think she's going to agree to this, but I will ask her. The man, the little alien, said, I think she will agree. And he thanked him, and he went back in his ship, and it departed. When that guy went home that night, he tried to tell his wife. She laughed at him. He tried to tell her again. She threw something at him. They had supper. He tried to tell her after supper again. She threw food at him. And he decided he'd give it up. He's not going to disturb her anymore. But when she's taking a bath that night, she began to think, where did he get this crazy idea? He doesn't do drugs. He's not exposed to anything. Maybe the only way I'll find out is go along with it, see where it goes. So the next morning when they got up, she said, you know, I've been thinking about this all night. If we can help another race evolve in some way, why don't we do it? You know, down there being pregnant is not a stigma like up here. The children are wealth in South America. They work from the time they can walk. So it's not a stigma for her to carry a fetus. So she said, tell them it'd be okay. So they came back again the next day. And the being said, what did she say? And he said, she'd think it wouldn't be any problem. And the being said, didn't I tell you? He said, we will meet you again in a short time. And then a week later, they were coming back in a plantation owner's, banana plantation owner's truck down a dirt trail on the plantation when the craft landed right in front of them and blocked the road. Pickup truck couldn't get by. The driver panicked, but Jose had seen the craft before, and he got out with his wife, and they walked to the craft where the ramp was down. The same little guy had met him. They walked aboard hand in hand. The alien asked her to get on the examining table. He touched the wall, and the examining table folded down. After she got on it under her own strength, with her husband holding her hand, and they performed the artificial insemination viewing screens top and side and end, and Jose could see her body on all of these screens. And the alien touched another panel, opened it, and took out a little bottle. It looked like it had blue jelly in it. He put a syringe in there and drew a drop of the blue jelly into the end of the syringe, then inserted it into the wife, watching on the screen so he could position it into the uterus with it. And positioned it, released a blob of green, blue jelly, and took the instrument out and put it back in the wall. And he said, he waited a few minutes watching the screens, and he said, turned to Jose and he said, she's now pregnant. And we'll be back to get it in time. It will develop in your wife's body. Well, while we were investigating that, we learned that there were 8 other Indian women that were also carrying fetuses put in by somebody else, that they were not sexually active enough to have gotten pregnant accidentally, and the tribes knew this. And the other eight, the aliens came back at almost exactly in the third month and removed the fetuses. This woman was still carrying the fetus after the third month and into the fourth month, and 10 days after the fourth month, they came back and took it. Here again, they landed in, they were picking oranges in an orange section of the plantation, landed right in the orange grove. Jose and his wife walked aboard hand in hand again. They motioned for her to get on the table. She did. They used another syringe-like device, but with a bigger barrel on it, and they inserted it through her vagina and up into the uterus and withdrew the little fetus with some placenta into the tube. And then he held it out like this and showed it to Jose, to the husband, and it wiggled. He moved its arms and legs, and he says, "It looks like it's alive." And the alien says, "It is." He said, "What are you going to do with it?" And he said, "We'll put it in an incubator now and finish the development and see whether we've had any success or not." He said, "Have you had any success at keeping these alive?" And he pointed to a small one standing in the corner watching. I said, "There's one." Well, those are really remarkable things. They're remarkable events. If it's happening to you, it's really a big thing.
And you don't have any reason to believe that he was making this up for you?
No, because we had the midwife that attended his woman. We had the doctors that examined her. We had the geneticist that examined her and studied the problem. The geneticist down there agreed that if it was an alien fetus and it was a placental form of birth, that it wouldn't have to have the same blood chemistry as the mother, because the blood chemistry had developed on the fetal side of the barrier. And the same way diseases are not transmitted from the mother to the baby here. And it could continue its own development in an earth mother up to a point. Mm-hmm. And they removed it before the critical point came.
But was she examined by...
She was examined by medical doctors, by a gynecologist, by the while she was still pregnant, she was examined by the midwife.
Okay.
We did hypnotic regression on both her and her husband. We had the testimony of the truck driver who was panicked when the craft landed in front of the car, the truck, engine quit and the lights went out, and he's sitting here, can't go anyplace, while it's on the ground and they're aboard and they're not coming out. And we had, of course, we had some againsters, too, to try to tell us that, no, it's not possible to use the argument with the geneticist that if it's an alien fetus, it's an alien fetus, and it can't grow in a human. The geneticist said that he didn't see any reason why it couldn't, that there, that we have successfully introduced other species types into humans, like a pig or a cow or a calf or something like that, to test. The development does start. And he said that we've even experimented with introducing human embryos into animals, and they start to grow. So he said he didn't see any reason why this couldn't have grown to the fourth month.
So she was checked by human doctors?
She was checked by human doctors in Guayaquil.
Mm-hmm. Both during the pregnancy and afterwards.
We didn't get her to a doctor during the pregnancy. Only the midwife saw her during the pregnancy. But after it was taken, we took her to a doctor.
And they could confirm that she had been pregnant?
She had been pregnant, yeah.
Okay. And does the story...
From body chemistry.
From body chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But has she had any contact with this child ever since?
No. No, but an interesting thing developed. These people were totally illiterate. They had never had a day in school. And they could write their names and some small, simple figures that they had learned in their mission church. Mm-hmm. But they weren't read. They didn't know anything about science. They didn't know anything about technologies. They were essentially illiterate. After the first contact, they began to use compound words that they had never been exposed to before. And after the second contact, they began discussing things in abstraction that they had no concept of before this. So we asked Jose, "How does this happen?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I asked him how they could speak my language, because they talked to each other in a different language." And he said that the little man told him, "We are henoglossic." Okay, there's a word that is... He could pronounce it. He had no idea what hendoglossic means. Jetoglossic it is in English, hendoglossic in Spanish.
Which means?
Universal speaker, universal language. So they were telling him in his language that they spoke a universal language, that they could speak any language they wanted to, is what hendoglossic means, or genoglossic. And it's a word that he had no way he could even look it up. He didn't have any dictionaries where he lived or textbooks or anything like that. So after the fourth time aboard the spacecraft, they're discussing scientific things in abstraction that they have been shown aboard and have discussed with the aliens. All this is happening to people that have never had a day of education in their lives. And it happened in a short time, you know, like 6 months. Mm.
I was wondering if you would share with me some of the things that you know about the Billy Meyer case. I know it's an enormously big topic, but could you kind of give me a short version of what you know?
It has drawn a lot of fire, too, because everything that rises above normal is going to be attacked by the attackers. And they work very furiously at it, but they never have substance. They never offer any substantial evidence to back up their arguments, usually just rhetoric. When I got to Switzerland the first time, and I'd been told that I would need a translator because he didn't speak English. And then, so I took Ilse von Jacobi from Germany with me, who was a journalist that wrote articles and read and spoke five languages, including English and German. And we got to his house, and we'd been invited inside and sat down at the kitchen table, and he came in from someplace else and sat down across from us, so women served us some coffee. And he looked up like, "Why are you here?" And I looked him in the eye and I said, "Billy, I just had to come see you and ask you some very critical questions. Do you mind?" I turned to my translator to translate, and he said, "No, Mr. Stevens, I do not mind. You may ask any questions you like." And my translator's mouth fell open. She says, "But he doesn't speak English." I said, "He just spoke English." She said, "He doesn't speak it." And I turned to Billy and I started talking to him. And I said, "Where did you learn English?" He said, "If you were a Chinaman or an Arab and sat down there to talk to me, I could talk to you." So I said, how do you do that? He said, "I don't know." But he said, "Proceed." So I started asking him questions, pointed questions about did he use models and things like that. He was a very simple man. He didn't carry any money. He claimed he was an anti-materialist. He had one arm missing. When I asked him a question, he looked me right in the eye. When I asked a question, he never looked away when he answered it. And I asked him if he used models. And he said, "Yes, I photograph models." He said, right after my experiences began, the first model was a young boy, a neighbor boy, in a shop class at school, turned out a model in wood on a lathe. And he brought that to me and wanted to give it to me, turned it out from the shapes he saw in the pictures. And he said it was a pretty good model, and I thanked him very much, and I took my camera and took pictures of it on the table and on a fence post and in the grass. And he said, when the pictures came back, I had two sets made, and I sent one to the family. The others I put in my pictures. So when I got there, his pictures were everywhere. They were in the pantry, they were in the living room, they were in the bedroom, there were some in the bathroom, there were some in the dog's bed, in the children's toy box. They were just everywhere because he didn't seem to be interested in the pictures. They were not the important thing to him. What they had to say was important. The pictures, he considered almost incidental at the time, and I thought the pictures were the most important thing that he had there. So I tried to get him under control, and finally, after 3 or 4 days there and not seeing anything happen to him, I bought 3 of those pocket albums, photo albums, at the store where we bought groceries. And after dinner that night, I pulled the albums out from under my chair and put them in front of him, and I said, "Billy, we've got to get your pictures under control. Find your pictures, all your pictures, and put them in there in the right order." And he took the albums and he smiled and handed them to an 8-year-old daughter or 10-year-old daughter and 8-year-old boy and said, "Here, go get the pictures and put them in the album." And they went around the house and gathered up pictures, stuck them in the album, wherever they found them, in the sequence that they picked them up. So they had UFO pictures, pictures of the tractor, pictures of the cow, the geese, chickens, people, garden, and more pictures of the ships and pictures of the model, all in there together. And they just put them on the album the way they found them. So after a couple of years of this, other people that had brought models, he did the same thing. He'd take pictures and give them a set, keep a set, just put it in the album. So there were pictures of models. There were about four or five different sets of pictures of models in the album by the time I got there. And I took him two models. When we started out, we had MGM Studios wanted to do a documentary on the case, and we had given them a dozen pictures, and they had their special effects department people build exact duplicates of the models, painted the exact color with the same kind of pearlescent finish, exact duplicates of what was photographed in the pictures. And they gave us two of them. They were 18 inches in diameter, and they gave us one that was suspended by three points around the rim that came to a point up like that. The other one was suspended by a point from the center of the disc so we could maneuver it different ways. We took both of those to Switzerland with us and took them out and hung them in the same scenes where Billy had taken his pictures and tried to get them right in exactly the same spot and have him re-photograph our model in the same scenery, which he did with his own same camera, taking the same positions and doing the same thing. And those pictures were patently models because they're too bright. They're brighter than anything else in the picture. They're too close to the camera. Mm-hmm. And so we quickly eliminated models in our testing, but we discovered during the testing that we learned a lot of things. For instance, we learned during the testing, starting with the Kodak Jet International in Rochester, New York, and then going to other photo imaging sciences and agencies, we discovered that we can take a flat two-dimensional photograph, black and white photograph, and we can change that black and white photograph to color by running a Z-scale on the shades of gray in the black and white, and then assigning the color values to the frequency values in the gray scale, and we can convert a black and white picture to full color. And we found that there, further on with more work with filters and so forth, we found that with filters we can reveal hot spots, radiation spots, electromagnetic emanations. We can tell if it has a radio and is broadcasting. We can tell if it has an engine that's generating heat. We can tell where the people are in the cabin, in the craft, from the heat emanation shown in the picture. And these are picked up from harmonics on the normal colors. But they're coming through infrared and ultraviolet and X-ray impingement on the visible rays. Mm-hmm. They're all harmonic, so one or another. And so we also learned that we can measure distance by six different methods from the lens to the horizon. Now, one of them is distance graying, atmospheric attenuation. You know, the near mountains are darker than the far mountains. That's called distance attenuation. But we have the same thing in color shift, chroma shift. The nearer an object is to the lens, the more red it has. The further away it is from the lens, the less red it has, and the red fades to blue or green on the horizon. So we can measure that change called chroma shift, and we can measure the particular point on that chroma scale where it is, and that'll tell us the distance from the lens. That's the second one. The third one is color saturation, which came with television. You know, the old set, you used to be able to, you had a little control on the back, you can make the picture brighter or dimmer. That's color saturation. Well, we learned that color is saturated, more saturated, the less distance to travel. So the closer it is to the lens, the more color saturation the image will have. The further it is, the less it will have. And anything in the picture will have this relative saturation depending on its distance from the lens. Yeah. So, and there are four more similar to that. So, and when we, in our testing, we found that all six of them came out within 10% of each other. So now we can clearly establish the distance from the lens as, say, 200 meters. Mm-hmm. Now, we had the serial number of everything in the camera, of Meyer's camera, and we went to the manufacturer lens, got the lens geometry, and we can, from knowing the distance from the lens and the geometry of the lens, we can mathematically calculate how far it was depending on the size measurement in the image frame. So then we could establish that we know it's already such and such a distance, that if it's at that distance, it's 21, 22 feet in diameter, which he really always estimated at 7 meters, which is about 21 feet. Mm-hmm. So we had accurate calculations on the distance. We rented a HERRUG laser surveying instrument to measure the distances in the of fixed objects in the pictures. So we had known distances, and we could assign those factors, either color shift, chroma shift, distance, attenuation, whatever factor, to the known distance of the object, and then a second known distance to another object. And then the computer, in a computer, you can create a scale. You can look at anything else in the picture and measure its distance in terms of the scale you just created in the computer. So that gave us a true measurement of, or a very relatively true measurement of all the images in there, and we were able to establish the distance, multiply it out. It always came out about 21 feet in diameter. So you can't do this with models. Mm. No way. And they wouldn't, if they were models, they wouldn't show up in a picture like that. Mm. Usually they would be closer, and all the factors would be off because chroma shift is not there, distance attenuation is not there, any of the other six. So color saturation, don't remember the others.
Yeah.
But it's we clearly established to our satisfaction that he could not have faked those pictures by any known method. Mm-hmm. And then we began to understand why they had posed the ships. When they first contacted Bill, the very first contact, when she got out of the ship and walked up to him, and they sat on the grass, and she said, "Nah, listen carefully. I have to tell you something very important. I want you to remember every bit of it." He said, "How will I do that? I have no pencil or notebook, and I no recording device." She said, "I'll help you." She said, "But listen carefully." So she spent 20 minutes telling him about the destruction of our ionosphere by the heavy gases, industrial gases. And she said, "By our measurements, you have already lost 6% of your ionosphere. And if you don't get it under control in 10 years, it could rise to 20%. And she said, "That's enough to cause serious mutation to begin." Mm-hmm. And that was in 1975. We didn't get any agreement on halting the production of such industrial gases until almost 1980. And the last measurement she gave him was over 20% of the destruction of our ionosphere. She says, "Mutation has already begun. And your life on your planet will never be the same 100 years from now." Hmm. Too late. We waited too long, and we poisoned ourselves. Hmm. But she says that's not the only poisoning. She said your radiation is even worse. She said your scientists understand the particle radiation, alpha, beta, and gamma radiation. She said they know nothing about fine particle radiation. One time Billy asked her what physical matter was. She says, "It's made up of fine matter." And he says, "What's fine matter?" She says, "It's astral matter. It's the non-physical matter before it becomes physical." He said, "Well, where does that come from?" She said, "Thought, concept now, the divine fiat. Thought creates. And the divine consciousness is constantly thinking and constantly creating." Mm. And so that and tells us why we are here and how we happen to be what we are doing. It's all in the mind of the creation. They don't have a God. They have the creation. It's an impersonal, unpersonified, omnipotent, omnipresent everything. Mm. Force that ensouls everything and everything becomes it. It's the sum of its creations, and it's constantly creating it. It thinks and creates. And I thought that was very interesting. It's their concept. As a matter of fact, in the 115 cases I mentioned to you, I found only one other society that had anything like a personalized God like we have. And they had a figure on the planet Umo that was a religious figure that they worshipped that was much lower than what the rest of them called the creation. It's a general term meaning everything that is and They argue that everything lives. Everything is emanated from thought, originates in thought, and everything that is produced by thought lives. Thought itself is the creation. And God is everywhere. Everything that lives and moves and has its being has its increment of the creation in it. What others, what the Christians would call God.
But in the case of Meyer, it's only he himself who has these contacts. Have he ever been able to take other people with him to verify the contacts?
You know, he wanted to take his wife to see them. Shortly after they were married, their children were young. Mm. He dearly wanted his wife to meet the Pleiadians. He wanted his best friend, who was a university professor in Austria. He wanted his right hand, Jacobus Berchinger, was a man, a drunk, that was standing on the rail of a bridge, going to jump in front of the train he was waiting for to commit suicide. Billy stopped his moped, talked him out, put him on the back of the moped, and took him home. And when he sobered up, he didn't want to commit suicide any longer, and he stayed with Billy, became his missing arm. Well, I don't know why I told you that. Anyway, what was the question?
If he ever was able to take other people with him.
Oh, okay. So he wanted to take Jacobus into the meeting with him. And Jacobus drove him to many of his rendezvous, and he would have Jacobus stop the car and get out and walk down into a forest to preserve out of sight of Jacobus for the contact. So, and he kept telling Semyasi that he wanted to bring these people in, and she would kept refusing. So a time came when he said, "Look, I don't understand your secrecy. Why can't I bring somebody else with me?" This was after he had, a woman came to the group and said, "I'm psychic. I'm in touch with Semyasi. He says I can come to the meeting, to your next meeting." So she stayed in the house. He put her on the back of his moped under a poncho, you know, hiding her, and rode off to the rendezvous. And he was in a forest alone on a just a narrow trail with this woman in not dressed for, on a January night in the cold. It was below zero. She didn't have any overshoes or heavy clothes or anything, taking her to the rendezvous with Semyasi because she said she was in contact with her. And Semyasi stopped him in the middle of the forest and said, "Put her off or we're leaving." So he made the woman get off. He went to the rest of the way to the rendezvous, and when he's aboard the craft and it's nice and warm, and he's sitting there, he says, "Don't you feel sorry for that poor woman out there in the cold in the forest?" And she said, "Well, yes, I do." But she said, "Why did you bring her?" He said, "She said she was in contact with you." She said, if she was really in contact with us, we would have told you." He said, "Look, I don't understand this secrecy. Why can't I bring my friends?" And she says, "It's very simple." She said, "The next pair of eyes and mind will see things different. No two minds and no two intelligences see the same thing the same way." She says, "There will be a differences in opinion of what they saw. You bring a third one in, there's another difference of opinion." She said, "In time, fourth, fifth, sixth, down the line, two of them will agree, and then maybe two others will agree, and then two more will agree. And further down, three will agree." She says, "That's factionalism." She says, "That's what happened to your Christian churches." She said, "There are 222 different sects now, each one believing they're the true sect, and the rest are all pagans." She says, "That's what would happen if we brought anybody else in." She says, "Now, there's no problem bringing more people in." She said, "We could entertain a dozen more, 100 more, 1,000 more. That's no problem for us. We could entertain as many as you want to bring, but factionalism will result. And that's against everything that we want to do. It just doesn't work." She says, "So now do you understand?" He said, "Yes, I understand." He never tried to bring anybody in with him later, and I never tried to follow him into a contact because I already understood what the reason was.
But the main message that they have given him, I mean, what are they trying to convey?
Well, apart from the destruction of our ionosphere and the danger to the planet, they, and this is what it got him crossways with everything worldwide, they criticized all religions. And she told him, "Even your word, religion, tells you it's wrong." She says, "They come from, religion comes from a Greek word, religion." She said, "You spell it R-E-L-I-G-I-O-N. She says, "That's religion. That's religion." She said, "You should have spelled it R-E-L-E-G-O-N. She said, "That would be the correct interpretation because that means," she says, "religion means tying yourself to the past, and religion means tying yourself to the future." She said, "You shouldn't be tying yourself to the past. Everything that you worship is happening in the past." She said, "You should be tying yourself to the future." She says, "All religions are wrong. She says, "Even communism, socialism, democracy are forms of religion. And," she said, "they all require you to follow certain precepts and believe certain things on faith alone." She says, "You should never accept anything on faith. You should always know why you want to believe it. Always know why you believe it. Never accept somebody else's concept or somebody else's opinion of what's reality." And that was the whole thing that got him crossways with everybody. All politics, all religions, all societies. She said, she just objected to, she said, "No man should bind himself to somebody to another intelligence. Yeah, everybody walks his own path in his evolution and in his development and his way to God. Mm. And she said, you shouldn't be contaminating it with other people's concepts.
Where do they, have they told him where they come from, specifically?
Yes. That group told him that they came from a third planet out in a small sun in the Taygeta system. And we were trying to pinpoint their location. And there's a lot of stars in the fleet. We see seven major stars, six of them actually now, and the seventh one is too dim to see with the naked eye. But Taygeta is one that we can still see with the naked eye. And we see Taygeta as one bright star, but the astronomers see Taygeta as a binary with a small violet companion, and they orbit on a common center. The small violet companion is the parent star for their sun system. The small violet companion, which is about 10 times the size of our sun, has a system of subsuns that have planets around them. So it's a complicated setup. So and they come from the third planet out of one of the subsuns in the Taygeta system, which Taygeta is a part of the, or the small violet sun is a part of the Taygeta system, which is a part of the Pleiades. So it was hard to pinpoint it, but she says that their parent sun is bigger than ours. Their planet, for one out just like ours, is a little bit bigger than Earth. It's much like Earth, but it's more craggy. It has less oceans and more land mass. It's a little bit cooler. As she says, the oxygen percentage is 3 or 4% higher than ours, and makes breathing easier. They have to adjust to ours when they get here, when they get on the ship here.
Okay. And how long do they usually, how long does it take to travel from there to Earth?
Well, that was an interesting thing. When we had him ask that, she said it takes us about 8 hours to make the distance from here to the fleet, to our sun system. Okay, now where were we?
How long it, how they travel?
How long it takes to get there? So we had him ask her, and she said it takes about 8 hours to make the trip, which is 504 light years from here. Mm-hmm. That's a big change. So we're stuck with an impossibility. All the scientists are going to laugh at us when we ask them that. But this is what I call synchronicity, because events happen out of our control. The picture book that we put out, the big picture book, which is an accident, we never intended to write a book or anything, that just fell together, was found on a bookshelf out in North Hollywood by David Froning's wife. David Froning was the lead engineer on the space shuttle project for McDonnell Douglas. And she bought the book and took it home. In the back of the book, we had asked the question about time to make the trip. And Semyasi had described how it took 8 hours. It took a certain time to get out of our solar system, about 3 or 4 hours. And then they would make an instantaneous jump for the major distance. And then it took a certain time to get into the solar system without interference from the systems. So she said the big jump happens in the blink of an eye. And she showed this to Froning, and Froning was already working on a project for more advanced propulsion systems than the ones in the shuttle for McDonnell Douglas. And he had already done some calculating, and when he saw the book, he said, and saw 8 hours, he said, Jesus, that's my figure. So he went back over his figures and did his recalculations, and he figured that it could be done in 8 hours. And he called us and wanted to know if we could give him more information, so we sent him our contact notes to read. And he kept working on it. Then he introduced us to another man that was working over in the control center in Houston, Alan Holt, who was also a theoretical physicist that was working on potential travel by other means than linear. And he happened to pick the Pleiades also because it's a bright system. And his calculations were showing 8 hours as an approximate time between the two. So we got Froning and Holt together, and we interviewed them like you're doing on camera for our production called Contact on this. And they described with their charts and phases exactly how the trip could be made, but it can't be made under our physical sciences concept. We have to think different. Mm-hmm. We have to think beyond our physical sciences to make the the theoretical leap. And it amounted to a change of dimensional reality for a short amount of the fraction of an inch between the two, and then maneuvering in again to the other solar, out of ours and into the main distance, took just a blink of an eye. And they both arrived at the same conclusions. And the following that year, they both made presentations before the Astronautics and Aerial Sciences Organization, the big AAIS. It's a scientific organization that recognizes cutting edge science. They both made presentations that year on theoretical trips involving less, greater than light speeds.